Dr. John Patrick, associate professor at the University of Ottawa Medical School, missionary and philosopher, addresses this topic in a very unique way as we look at the ethics and moral principles involved in allocating resources in medicine. I know you're going to enjoy this tape.
I want to talk about a problem of modern medicine, limited resources in medicine. I contend that this is an area of logical conflict without, at the moment, a very rational resolution that everyone will agree with. There's a specter, basically, haunting the practice of medicine. Medicine, as we have known it, may become financially insupportable. In the developing world, the provision of even a modicum of medical care is beyond the resources of the poorest countries. The prospect of these developing world nightmares impinging on Western lives is leading physicians to think in unphysicianly ways. They are beginning to accept the role of gatekeepers, and financial considerations are beginning to distort some areas of medical practice. The idea that cost-benefit, judged from a societal perspective, could legitimately influence what used to be primarily medical decisions is gaining ground. The ethical and philosophical implications of this change in practice are hardly mentioned, although history suggests they should be considered as mortal threats to the body politic. This paper will attempt, therefore, to provide a Christian perspective, juxtaposing and contrasting this to the secular faith which is dominant in the corridors of power. It will further propose the thesis that the problem is not primarily one of either economics or technology, but of culture, or more precisely, the lack of culture. In neither the medical fraternity nor in society as a whole do we have the moral consensus necessary for what everyone would accept as just and equitable. The basic limited resource is therefore cultural rather than material. As a society, we have agreement on neither the meaning of life nor the role of compassion, and cannot therefore expect to agree on what constitutes justice in the provision of medical services. The basic economic facts are not in dispute. It is often said that we spend about half our lifetime medical budget in the last few months of our lives. And though I have not been able to find so extreme a set of figures, there are plenty of figures very close to that. In Ontario, where I work, 30% of our budget is spent on health, and 40 to 50% of acute care resources are consumed by the over 65 age group. New technologies are producing new possibilities for therapy, many of which are horrendously expensive. When erythropoietin first became available, for example, it could not be given to everyone because the cost was not possible. A heart-lung transplant at that time was something of the order of $150,000 to $200,000. Such treatments could not be given to everybody who would benefit from them. For some time now, lung transplantation has not been offered by the British National Health Service, but it is offered privately if you can raise the money. Meanwhile, in the poorest countries of the world, the problems are even more acute, with less than $5 per person per year available for health services. And even short curative treatments like cyclophosphamide for Burkitt's lymphoma are often unavailable, not to mention diabetics dying for lack of insulin, a problem aggravated by the switch from extracted insulin to modern molecular biology-produced insulin, which is more expensive. Maurice King, after many years of working on health problems in developing world, has become disillusioned to the point where he has argued that very simple technology like oral rehydration therapy should not be provided in countries already entrapped in what he calls the ecological problem of a population too big to be supported by its material resources. Astonishingly, the main argument he presented was that it is unethical to treat gastroenteritis because by so doing you merely condemn the children to death by starvation. In the past, we had less rather than more resources in material terms, more rather than less starvation, less rather than more food. So what has happened? I will argue that the missing resource was contained in our forgotten heritage, which provided a story of how to care for the sick and disabled while continuing to recognize that it is given unto man once to die and after that the judgment. Now we have replaced that humble acknowledgement with a healthcare industry which is expected to provide all our needs and desires. We now have a vast cast of almost invisible actors from the industrial and pharmaceutical sector, each pushing for their own limited agendas. Note that I am not implying that they push unethically. We also have a burgeoning management elite who refer to themselves by such terms as president, chief executive, etc., all in addition to the old players in this drama. Medicine is trapped between two worlds, one ancient story which grew out of concern, compassion, and the newer story which never stops long enough to consider any deeper meanings, but like a soap opera simply moves from event to event. In this new story, we, the actors, respond only in immediate terms. We live from one page of street to the next. In this frenetic world, we have not time to stand and stare, much less to ponder. Despite possessing an adequate spiritual base, within a meaningful, morally consistent tradition which does provide answers, we behave as though we have none. Instead, we are blown about by every new wind of doctrine towards solutions in tune with the spirit of the age, reductionist and technological solutions that emphasize human autonomy, even when it is farcical to pretend we have any. This pathetic play-acting is dressed in euphemisms, where we talk of value-free, purely practical decisions, which in reality are decisions based on the logical consequences of secularism, or practical atheism, as Sproul calls it. Value-free is usually code for anti-Christian. The purely practical solutions which this process is generating include, for unplanned pregnancy, abortion instead of respect for life. For sexually transmitted diseases, condoms instead of chastity and fidelity. For death, behaviorist psychology, euthanasia, and tranquilizers in place of meaning. Physicians are deeply troubled, often without being able to give voice to the causes of their disquietude. Physicians have long centered their profession on listening to the patient's story and on the capacity to interpret those stories, to recognize the gaps, the omissions, the cries for help, and the laments. It is the natural extension of medical histories, narrative ethics, that I will turn to next in this paper. It is not surprising that those ethicists who have left the ivory tower and are working in the clinical area are tending to value narrative more than theory, because they find that although people do not agree on guiding principles, they do often reach a consensus as to what makes sense within the patient's story, a phenomenon clinicians have known for centuries. We should beware of letting academicians, whose understanding is rooted in the so-called Enlightenment, tell us, who are part of a much older story, how we ought to live. By their fruits you shall know them, and Paul Johnson has done us a great service in showing what their fruits really are in his book The Intellectuals. So, let us look at what is currently proposed to control the escalating budget for medicine and try to disentangle the family trees of these various ideas, to distinguish those ideas which have the same roots as medicine and those which have a less prestigious ancestry. The list of proposals is long, but here briefly listed are some of the major ones. That we should limit services on the basis of age, length of benefit, social utility in various disguises, quality of life criteria, cause of the condition, and medical benefit. All except the last are variants of some form of social utility judgment wearing more or less camouflage. Medical benefit is different, though easily confused. Let's look at age. The idea that some treatments would be restricted purely on grounds of old age is acceptable to many North Americans. Many African societies, on the other hand, would be more concerned to save the lives of the older members of their society, whom they see as repositories of wisdom and as more essential to the social fabric, and therefore leaving a larger rent when they die. They will use young age as a criterion for denial of treatment. Both views are utilitarian, but the African view seems to me to have more respect for the person. We as physicians often include age in our assessments of which treatment to offer. Thus we are immediately on the defensive in any discussion between those who champion the limitation of services to the elderly, because it seems we've already moved to the point of acceptance. However, I would suggest that our use of age is in most cases not as a simple cut-off procedure, but merely as a surrogate for medical benefit. We need to be much more precise in our use of language to say what we mean, namely that because of the frailties of age, we deem the medical benefit to be small or even negative. It is relatively simple to prove that this is our real meaning, because we all readily approve of procedures on, quotes, young 90-year-olds. When one says that a procedure is inappropriate to give an age, it should mean that the likelihood of real medical benefit is small. If, however, one espouses an age criteria other than for reasons of physiological frailty, one is guilty of treating people as things and of not attending to the individual person. The argument in favor of limiting medical resources on arbitrary age grounds has been put very cogently by Daniel Callahan. He emphasized that over 85-year age group is the fastest growing group in the USA, and that by early in the next century, the elderly will consume 45% of the health budget if the trends continue. Already it estimated that 1% of the GNP is used for the elderly in their very last year of life. He further argues that the medical need for a heart transplant is the same in both 90-year-olds and 30-year-olds with terminal heart failure, so that a medical benefit process to allocate resources will not work. This is somewhat naive in that it fails to take into account the diminished functional reserve of all systems that is the hallmark of aging, and that will be a major determinant of outcome. Thus, a decision to refuse a transplant in an elderly patient should be the traditional one based on the judgment that the older patient does not have the physical reserves to withstand the metabolic demands of surgery and recovery. The figures for use of medical funds in the last year of life in the elderly should not be used as a reason for a blanket denial of all treatment to the elderly, but as a salutary reminder that we still have much to learn about the recognition of terminal events. When a person has entered upon their dying, and we know that, only comfort is ethical. Excessive treatment is unethical. It's meddlesome medicine. What about the question of the length of benefit? At first sight, it would seem that a limited resource that would give an extra year of life should be given preferentially to the young. However, a moment's consideration shows that this is just another version of ageism. We have no means of judging between the young and the oldest groups. For example, one might be old, wise, and gracious, an immense source of hope and comfort to others, whilst the younger one may be totally self-obsessed. On the other hand, where a procedure is expensive and curative, the young have a social advantage in life expectancy after cure. In most cases, however, prognosis is so inexact a skill that its application to the judgment between two individuals would be just difficult to justify. So what about social utility? Age and various forms of social valuing of people, more or less camouflage, are and will be widely, though usually tacitly, used as justification for the denial of treatment to some groups, such as the severely disabled child. These responses are not usually well thought out and are often merely reflections of the prevailing ethos. Discussions which involve personhood and lives not worth living always require that we pay great attention to the definitions. Definition of persons varies from the obvious one of all living creatures of the human species to frightening concepts like persons are only those capable of moral agency, which would clearly allow infanticide and even the death of small children. Medicine has been infected by such shoddy rhetoric. One does not have to be too acute of hearing to catch conversations in hospital corridors where justification for the denial of treatment is linked to concepts of social utility without any remonstrance from anyone else. There have been a few cases in the literature where patients initially denied treatment such as dialysis were defended by others and given treatment. If we allow social utility arguments to gain respectability, the consequences for such medicine will be catastrophic. For example, a large number of pediatricians spend their time caring for children who will never have useful lives, judged by economic utility criteria. In my opinion, they have a much more important function. They give us cause to see our own future dependence at a stage when we can use that insight to modify our behavior and become more compassionate. The early problems with choosing who should have access to dialysis treatment illustrate the pitfalls that surround social utility decisions. The nephrologists in Seattle were faced with an acute problem when they provided the first chronic dialysis in North America. Who should they accept and who refuse? The initial attempts to choose between people produced unbearable tensions for the committee, so that in due course, those who attained medical suitability criteria were all entered into a lottery. So what about quality of life? Closely associated with ideas of social utility is this idea of quality of life. It is even reduced to an acronym, QALY, Quality Adjusted Life Years. George Grant has described these ideas as the ultimate definition of fascism, for reasons which we will discuss in a moment. If the quality of life could be defined as inadequate by the patient at the time of illness, it might seem to be acceptable. But as a recent article in the New England Journal has made plain, even this is difficult because it can take some patients 5 years to come to terms with incapacity and once again value their lives. None of us is required to take treatment, but this study shows how sensitively these issues need to be handled if our right to autonomy is not to lead to needless deaths. When an anonymous committee makes a decision for us, the only hope is that Kafkaesque bureaucracy will prevent any decision emerging. As Grant pointed out, this is legalizing the right to kill without redress. One wonders whether those who think in terms of quality of life ever attended to the role of those who suffer in our society, or ever considered the role of suffering in the literature of the world. Listen to Bonhoeffer, for instance. In the sight of God, there is no life that is not valued, that is not worth living, for life itself is valued by God. The beggar Lazarus, a leper, lay at the rich man's gate, and the dogs licked his sores. He was devoid of any social usefulness, and a victim of those who judge life according to its social usefulness. Yet God held him to be worthy of eternal life. And where, if not in God, should lie the criterion for the ultimate value of a life? We cannot ignore the fact that the supposedly worthless life of being curable evokes from the healthy the very highest measure of self-sacrifice and even genuine heroism. This devoted service, which is rendered by sound life to sick life, has given rise to real values which are of the highest utility to the community. For me, perhaps one of the most beautiful examples of this importance of suffering and of the disabled and handicapped in our society is the story of Helen Keller. Listen to her describing the wonder of Anne Sullivan's success in teaching her to communicate. It was true that one summer day in Alabama a miracle occurred. Helen Keller up to that point had learned to respond like any other good animal. When she wanted a piece of cake, she spelled the word in Miss Sullivan's hand and Miss Sullivan fetched her the cake. An animal could be taught to do that. But then, Helen Keller writes as follows. We walked down the path to the well house, attracted by the fragrance of the honeysuckle with which it was covered. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over one hand, she spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motion of her fingers. Suddenly I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that W-A-T-E-R meant the wonderful cool something that was flowing over my hand. The living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. There were barriers still, it is true, but barriers that could in time be swept away. I left the well house that day, eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life. That was because I saw everything with a strange new sight that had come to me. On entering the door, I remembered the doll I had broken. She'd earlier destroyed the doll in a fit of temper. I felt my way to the hearth and picked up the pieces. I tried vainly to put them together. Then my eyes filled with tears. For the first time I felt repentance and sorrow. I learned a great many new words that day. I do not remember what they all were, but I do know that mother, father, sister, teacher were among them. Words that were to make the world blossom for me, like Aaron's rod with flowers. It would have been difficult to find a happier child than I was as I lay in my crib at the close of that eventful day and lived over the joys it had brought me. For the first time, I longed for a new day to come. The subsequent impact of Helen Keller's life on those around her that continues to this day cannot be denied. Few who are fit and healthy have ever given so much to our society. Those who think in terms of quality of life would have destroyed her with her initial illness. Lives which might have been judged as without social utility from any objective viewpoint at one moment have so often turned out for the enrichment of all. Though the fig tree bear no blossom, though there be no fruit on the vine, yet, says Habakkuk, joy. Life, as Kierkegaard said, has to be lived forwards, but can only be understood backwards. Only a fool or a reductionist would presume to know what the quality of another's life will turn out to be in that day where the first shall be last and the last first. Now we can see only hints through a glass darkly. But hints there are, and they can fill the heart with warmth. Two such stories have moved me recently. I had a child in whom I was placing a permanent feeding gastrostomy button in the first few months of its life because it was severely neurologically impaired and had virtually no swallowing mechanism. The baby was the fourth child of a woman in her 40s, an unplanned pregnancy. This mother was coping exceedingly well with this problem. So well that I said, "Do you mind telling me why you're doing so well?" Her response was wonderful. She said, "My children had grown up and left home. I was suffering from the empty nest syndrome, So God sent me a child who will never grow up. Trust in God's wisdom had transformed a disaster into an experience to be accepted with joy. But she went on to tell me even more, how all the neighbourhood children are fascinated by her son. She lives in a relatively poor neighbourhood with many latchkey children. But now they don't return to their latchkey homes. They come to see her son, so they can all have the fun of feeding him through the tube. And this child who will never speak, never feed himself, never walk, is civilizing a whole neighborhood as she teaches them how to be gentle, how to take their turn. We little understand what it is that makes us human. And when we have the hubris to think that we can determine which life is of value and which is not, we have come to the end of civilization. The other story is found in Colson's recent book, The Body. It's the story of Rusty Woomer, a young man who as a child had been beaten by his alcoholic father and later became a juvenile delinquent, inevitably using drugs. Then he murdered several people whilst on a drug-induced rampage. He was convicted and sentenced to death. When a prison fellowship worker was confronted by him, he had already in one sense died. His cell was filthy, even cockroaches were crawling over him. But by God's grace and the foolishness of witnessing, that meeting changed Rusty Woomer. The result was the miracle of conversion, a story of grace which I have no doubt will be used to move others all over the world. He became a new creature. He apologized for what he was done. It did not stop his execution. For many, he had no social utility, and his death was the obvious solution. But were they right? I don't think so. The need for us all to realize that neither families nor nations can have everything they desire is undeniable. But families who never needed quality of life measurements to decide who gets what, neither should nations need such measurements. How far we have fallen if we lose all sense of noble self-sacrifice and resort to quaylies. In a moment we will discuss the Oregon proposal and the governmental response which focused on the effects of the quality of well-being scale they used. It served to label the disabled as second-class citizens. The Oregon listing of diseases placed liver transplant for cirrhosis unrelated to alcohol at 367, i.e. a funded level, whilst a transplant for alcoholic cirrhosis was placed at 690, i.e. an unfunded level. This appears to be a straightforward example of judgmental morals, which should be unacceptable to Christians. But the denial of transplantation to alcoholics, showing no evidence of rehabilitation, has been justified on the grounds of diminished likelihood of both compliance with and benefit from the treatment. Doubt has been recently expressed as to the truth of these statements. Of course, even this approach has huge problems, for example, with AIDS, where it seems that it would be possible to be infected by more than one strain of HIV. Should withdrawal from high-risk activities be required for some treatments? These are issues which must be brought into the arena of public discussion. For Christians, the idea of limiting treatment because disease is self-induced is unacceptable. Our Lord's famous question is enough to silence us as it did the Pharisees. He that is without sin, let him cast the first stone. The ideas of consequence and responsibility, however, surely have a place in how we run our society. But it will be a very nuanced approach that will be needed. When we turn to the traditional medical benefits approach, this is easier. This has been the traditional approach of medicine. Often it has been contaminated by various isms, paternalism, sexism, racism, and class bias. Nevertheless, the objective of physicians has been to do no harm and to do the best for their patients. Objectives which necessarily involve subjective judgments are inevitably modified by the biases of the physician. The fact that age, sex, class, race enter into our decisions does not make our judgments necessarily ageist, sexist, snobbish, or racist. I do not think that most blacks and Asians would accuse one of racism for taking into medical account the racially determined fact that they are more likely to have 6 GPD deficiency than Caucasians. We must expect that the public will be looking more carefully for bias in our judgments in the current political climate. This will serve to make us more aware and more sensitive, which can only be good. I would be opposed to the development of bureaucratic procedures to monitor these biases. But I think we shall only resist this outcome if we show that we are already aware of the problems and making efforts to remedy our biases. We must do all we can to rebut those arguments which imply that our decisions are not primarily based upon medical benefit. Where we are shown to be wrong, we can gracefully admit it and change. The Oregon proposal was derived from a very complex discussion process which attempted to involve a wide cross-section of citizens. This involved the generation of a generic list of condition treatment pairs, e.g. acute fatal conditions for which treatment cures completely, and to more problematical pairs where treatment is not a complete cure. These generic categories were then ranked by a weighted assessment, which was 40% a judgment of value to society, 20% value to the individual, and 40% degree of essentiality to basic care. 709 specific treatment condition pairs, such as penicillin, strep throat, or end-stage renal failure and dialysis, were then ranked by placing them in the above categories. Further modifications of the rank order were achieved by using a quality well-being index and a literature outcome data survey. Finally, there was a test of reasonableness, which was considered public health impact, effectiveness of treatment, cost of treatment and non-treatment, incidence of the condition and social costs. Discussion of this proposal can be found in many reviews. The major positive aspect of the process was that the gatekeeper function was appropriately located in the public and political arena and not in the private decision of the physician. As Christians, we must bring up some criticisms. From the Christian perspective, most of the criteria for limiting medical treatment have three defects in common. They depersonalize the patient, who becomes no more than a statistical prognosis. They are arrogant in their assumption of capacity to judge outcomes. And finally, they allow people without experience of particular diseases and disabilities to decide whether life with these problems is dignified. The driving engine is actually cost-benefit analysis, measured primarily in monetary terms. This is not surprising in a productivity-obsessed society like ours. Sadly, I believe there is also a much more serious process at work, which the obsession with economics is merely a symptom. Up until recently, we would always have put the duty to preserve the life of another person first, well over any other consideration, with little or no question. Now we have changed. There may be an element of subconscious self-interest as we consider our own future comfort, our own hopes for future prosperity. The price of this change in priorities is high, for it involves denial of our traditional understanding of life and its replacement with a more fatalistic one, in which we are training ourselves to accept statistical probabilities as accomplished fact, and in which the belief in a divine providence is lost. We assume we are alone in a universe devoid of meaning, except such meaning as we create. Kersler's book Darkness at Noon portrayed the logical outcome of this in all its stark horror. Justice is no longer blind to all the established facts, but partial and influenced by what is perceived to be the likely future monetary liability of healthcare choices for society as a whole. In reality, of course, the rich will get what they want somewhere in the world, but will have less responsibility for their own poor. Currently, monetary consequences for the living taxpayer control the agenda, except in the case of abortion. But what is to stop it being construed in genetic, sexist, or racial terms rather than economic? Once the old story is traded in and utility accepted, it will have immense implications, as the Germans discovered in the 1930s. Stanley Hauerwas has described the way we can at least begin to understand these paradigm shifts by the use of narrative. I want to comment on one example he used in a beautiful essay on Richard Anum's book, Watership Down. For those unfamiliar with the story, it will be enough to tell you that it is about the journey and adventures of a ragtag group of rabbits who leave their home warren to found a new warren. We learn of the importance of sustaining traditions in story, which in this case is centered around El Arera, the rabbit hero of the past. We are treated to a wonderful exposition on the nature of society because the rabbits leave a class-ridden authoritarian society, battle with a totalitarian pseudo-Marxist society, deal with an existential society, and found, finally, their own warmly human, or should I say rabbity, community. They also briefly enter the nameless existential warren, which I wish to comment upon. In the unnamed warren, rabbits had traded in the natural virtues of rabbits for the comfort of an assured food supply, but at the cost of random deaths by members of the warren. A farmer had realized that providing food for the rabbits, he could also secure his own meat supply by snaring without the cost of hutches, etc. One of the consequences of the rabbit's fatalistic choice was that their society lost its structure, and the traditional rabbit virtue of cooperation and care for one another was also lost. It no longer needed a chief rabbit. For a chief rabbit must be El Arera to his warren and keep them from death. And here there was not death, but one, and what chief rabbit could have an answer to that? Instead, Frith sent them strange singers, beautiful and sick like oak apples, like robin's pincushions on the wild rose. And since they could not bear the truth, these singers, who might in some other places have been wise, were squeezed under the terrible weight of the Warren's secret until they gulped out fine folly about dignity and acquiescence, about death with dignity, and anything else that they could make believe that a rabbit could love the shining wire. But one strict rule they had, oh yes, the strictest. No one must ever ask where another rabbit was, and anyone who asked where, except in a song or poem, must be silenced. To say where was bad enough, but to speak openly of the wires, that was intolerable. For that they would scratch and kill. We are approaching this state with our inability to call killing by its rightful name in abortion and euthanasia. The Germans did the same when they falsified the death certificates of the insane and handicapped whom they killed in the 1930s, because they argued there were insufficient resources to feed useless mouths. The initial arguments were economic, not racist. The first to die were the handicapped, not the Jews. Realism does not require us to limit the expenditure on medicine. Justice requires that those limits be imposed justly and with full public discussion. The only way that I can conceive of this being done is in some version of a medical benefits policy that will require a given level of efficacy to be demonstrated for treatments before they are provided, and where in terms of medical benefit, as cure or symptom relief, regardless of age or sex, etc. Quality of life approaches should be avoided as far as possible. If we cannot offer treatment justly, it should not be offered at all. Justice is more important than health. Health without justice is an empty shell devoid of meaning, without which there is not health. Active euthanasia is the ultimate technological and bureaucratic solution to limited resources. But since all but very few people are physically capable of committing suicide, there is no obvious need for legalized euthanasia for droves of patients clamoring vainly for death. So what is the driving force? It has to be economic and doctrinaire. It has all happened before. In the 1930s, Germany was the most advanced and cultured and technologically competent society in Europe. It was more civilized and more humane in many respects than most other countries. But nevertheless, it began to be accepted that there was a limit to what could be done. So the next step was to put into practice euthanasia for the socially useless. The usual story of euthanasia in Germany is that it resulted from secret orders of Hitler, but this is not true. There was no such order. Wertheim wrote, "The tragedy is that psychiatrists acted on their own. They were not carrying out a death sentence pronounced by someone else. They laid down rules for who was to die. They were the administrators who worked out the procedures, decided the methods of killing. They were the executioners, or they surrendered their patients to be killed. It was accepted by the leaders of the profession." There are different explanations of how it began, with involvement, with abortion and capital execution, or with initially isolated mercy killings, or with the acceptance of the idea of life not worth living. But by the end of the Second World War, 270,000 people had been killed under the rubric of euthanasia. Once the policy of killing the socially unwanted was accepted, the Nazi policy of killing the racially unwanted was irresistible. Only a healthy profession dedicated to its own history and traditions will resist this onslaught. The history that we have is important. The names that we need to discuss first are Aesculapius and Hippocrates. Aesculapius and his followers accepted the traditional role for physicians, which combined healing and killing. For example, of defective newborns. Hippocrates was the first to realize the importance of totally separating killing and healing. Margaret Mead understood this, that he separated killing and curing, that he made everyone's life equally valuable, and that this was the priceless possession that made Western medicine possible. But now we are beginning to applaud the physician who kills. Soon we will return to fearing our physicians once more, wondering whether he is the healing or the killing mode. If the dominant mode of understanding our personal meaning changes, so will the nature of our hospitals. Indeed, who can deny that that has not already happened? In my own university, a senior physician recently told a medical student that palliative care had no place in medicine because it did not cure. The concept of medicine without care is not new. It can be seen anywhere in the world where the effect of the Christian story is minimal. The whole story of hospitals illustrates this reality. Patients have always wanted to know about their sickness and have sought out clever physicians to provide this service. But healing is different. This is with a physician who cares. Healing is always sought out by the sick, but the sick were not capable of creating institutions for healing. That required a particular cultural ethos. The history of hospitals is very incomplete, but the critical role of Christian belief is undeniable. Although some historians claim that hospitals began as early as the 5th century BC in Sri Lanka and India, these early institutions were more concerned with health and social management of death than what would be recognized as medicine today, and they did not achieve a permanent place in their societies. There was a change with the early Christians, who were noted for the fact that they did not expose their own children and rescued the exposed children of others. Infanticide has been and still is considered ethical in many cultures. The Council of Nicaea in 375 AD directed that institutions be established for the poor and needy following the multiple biblical injunctions. The subsequent development of these caring institutes proceeded through Nestorian Christians to Muslims to the monasteries and the Knights of St. John, who were taught that the sick were their lords. Science came later. Compassion and Christian obedience, consequent upon our Lord's teaching about the poor, laid the foundation. Other cultures tend to look upon poverty as a consequence of wrongdoing or as the individual's karma, even as the Old Testament in many places seems to imply. It was Jesus who said, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." Without its Christian underpinnings, institutional medicine is out of control. It was the same in the past. Listen to these words. "Do not imagine that it was by force of arms that our ancestors made a great nation out of a small community. If that were true, we should today have a far more glorious nation. In allies, in our own citizens, in armaments, we have greater resources than they enjoyed. But it was other causes that made them great, causes that have ceased to exist. Energy in our own land, a rule of justice, and informing policy, a mind that is free because it is not at the mercy of criminal passions. Instead of these, we have self-indulgence and greed, public poverty and private opulence. We praise riches. We pursue a course of sloth. No distinction is made between good men and bad. The intrigues of ambition win the prizes due to merit. No wonder when each of you thinks only of his own private interest, when at home you are slaves to your appetites and to money and influence in your public life. The consequence is that an attack is being launched on a republic left without defense." Augustine used this quotation from Cato in the City of God as he prepared the Christian world for the Dark Ages. "Private opulence and public poverty are signs of moral decay. What is it that prevents this decay? Clearly it is not conversion, because it is not peculiar to Christianity." Cato's point has been made by many people in the recent past, particularly effectively by McIntyre and Bloom, whom sadly we have not time to discuss here. Suffice it to say that both in different ways pointedly criticize the deficiencies of post-Enlightenment thinking. But it was Professor Waelke who radically changed my thinking. He made a deep impression on me a few years ago when he expounded Deuteronomy 6. It was there, I think, I began to understand the difference between conversion and virtue. I now consider the distinction to be an essential tool of Christian thought, and one which has many applications to medical practice, both here and also in different cultures. It has profound potential for changing our understanding of the problem of limited resources in the practice of medicine. Conversion I would take to be the change that comes about when we see things differently. In the Christian context, it is the point at which we are born of the Spirit and see the incomprehensible, as in John 3. Christian virtue is what comes about when Christian communities, and especially Christian families, put down roots and try to sincerely obey the commands of the Bible and teach the stories of the Bible to their children. These stories, talked about in the home, become the moral principles of the lives that are lived from that home. These virtues become the foundations of our lives, tacitly understood principles that are never seriously questioned. Indeed, when deeply ingrained, as in the Middle Ages, they are hardly even acknowledged. Other societies from ours also have similar patterns of virtue, but they are based on different understanding of God and therefore have logically different consequences. Conversion should, but does not always, lead to virtue. Even when it does, it will take time, and the commitment to a way of life that logically follows from conversion That means a great deal of thought. It will not initially be tacit, but the result of working out our own salvation with fear and trembling. Those brought up in such an environment, even though they do not embrace the faith in experience of conversion, nevertheless are formed by its ethics and the way of life, and their virtue all come from that upbringing. The Scots express this in proverbial terms. They said, "The doctors and the lawyers are the children of the manse." It might be legitimately demanded, what has this to do with limited resources? The virtues of a society determine how the society habitually behaves. Furthermore, the virtues are hierarchical, and the hierarchy is not fixed but changes with both time and place as well as belief. As long as the virtues of our society were rooted in the belief that our lives were in God's hands and that after death there is a judgment, certain virtues were inevitable. Now, in our own post-Christian country, the apparent hierarchy of virtues is no longer Christian. Individual rights and tolerance have been lifted above truth and justice. Societal ideas about what is acceptable change. Ours are changing rapidly at present. We have become a society which may still for the most part believe in God, but certainly does not fear God, and certainly does not love him with all its heart and strength and mind. If one cynically analyzes the throwaway medical press, it appears that for the medical community, after the need to know what is coming up in the area of applied medicine, money, cars, travel and wine all rank higher than any concern about what we believe. We are in the Brobdingnagian state of building our houses from the roof down. Empirically, it would appear that we understand ourselves as machines with material and emotional needs. Students understand medicine as the collection, collation and analysis of material facts under the headings of biology, psychology and sociology. Medical educationalists who see their roles in terms of knowledge, skills and attitudes, which can only be measured as behaviours. Skinnerite medicine, with neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor help for pain, but simply a darkling plain where ignorant armies clash at night. Such an understanding has its necessary correlates. If we are just animals, here for 70 or 80, perhaps a few more years, till the palsy shakes our last few sad grey hairs, then we should grab what we can while we can. There is no real basis for any other behaviours, and the solution to healthcare costs will be a solution based on power, the power of wealth, of status, of connection. In Britain and in the States, two or more tier medical care is already a reality. It is a logical, inevitable, unavoidable consequence unless we re-examine our basic premise. Only if we are not just animals can a different scenario be realistically imagined. Medicine in the West is rooted in almost 2,000 years of Christian history. That history has taught us that we are creatures, but not just creatures. We are made in the image of God, but we are deeply flawed. And who could deny that with Bosnia, Somalia, Rwanda so close to us? We once knew and rejoiced in the story of the Church, which preached the gospel of salvation from the domination of sin by the power of the sacrifice of Jesus, who by his Spirit lives within the Church. That powerful story has proved its truth in history. The weak things have confounded the mighty. But this story not only changed individual lives, it changed politics, bringing great gifts in hospitals, schools and universities, taking away the abominations of slavery, child labour, inhumane prisons, and destroying tyrannies. We have no cause to be ashamed or intimidated. To deny the Bible a place in a school so as not to offend some minorities is to destroy the very things those migrant minorities came for. We castrate and bid the gelding be fruitful. It is impossible. Once we see ourselves again as creatures loved of God, all is transformed. We will no longer be driven to exert control in every situation, but we'll see more clearly. Even such is time that takes in trust our youth, our joys, and all we have, and pays us but with age and dust, who in the dark and silent grace, when we have wandered all our ways, shuts up the story of our days, and from which earth and grace and dust the Lord shall raise me up, I trust. So wrote Walter Raleigh with tranquil acceptance of the story God gave him. When we return to that story with that degree of trust, we will no longer have a funding crisis in medicine, because we will have learned again how we ought to die. We will need neither euthanasia, nor living wills, nor infanticide, nor suicide. The norm will be once more to die in our homes and communities, and to be buried from our churches. There is no Christian requirement to accept every therapy offered, but only the need to be within God's will.